when people consider the nutritional requirements of working dogs, most commonly you would think they need extra calories. They need, you know, maybe higher levels of protein because of the physical exertion associated with their roles. And that certainly may be true, but there are other considerations that we really need to keep in mind: the stress associated with the travel, the environmental exposure, whether it's high heat, whether it's, you know, severe cold. There's some real serious considerations that we need to give to keeping that gastrointestinal tract healthy and so that we can keep those dogs working.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with nonlinear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Blending passion for customer success with love for pet nutrition, Trow Nutrition. Kemin Nutrisurance is your pet food and rendering partner every step of the way. Biorigin, your partner in yeast ingredients for palatability, immunity, and nutrition. Trusted ingredients, proven performance. Rengen Pet Nutrition, we partner with a purpose.
Hello, and welcome to the Pet Food Science Podcast brought to you by Y-Snetics. I'm Jan Sogodolski, dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the pet food science industry. So get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episodes. It is my really pleasure to meet, to introduce today, Dr. Erin Perry. Perry is a professor at Southern Illinois University, and really her very strong interest is in sports dogs and, you know, performance dogs. And so we're going to discuss a lot today how performance dogs, sports dogs are different, or what different requirements do have to pet dogs. So Erin, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation.
Great, Erin. I'm always like to actually kind of let my guests introduce themselves a little bit, because we have a very wide audience, from ranging from grad students all the way to professionals, specialists, and also in the pet foods industry. So I know that you did, you know, you work, you're a professor in Southern Illinois at the moment, but you had a lot of experience. You worked with the FEMA, I think. You worked with the DOD, Department of Defense, and so on. So maybe can you tell us a little bit where you started? How was your academic career and all your collaborations in the world of sports dogs?
So I completed my bachelor's was in animal science, and then my master's and PhD were both focused on animal nutrition. And I actually started, my master's degree was in feedlot nutrition in cattle. And so I was working with the microbiome long before it was really cool, because the ruminant people have had that dialed in for quite some time. I really wanted to dive into something a little bit deeper. And so for my PhD, I started working with horses. And after I had the opportunity to graduate, I took a position working with Purina Animal Nutrition. And when I was with Purina, I had the opportunity to work with just a wide variety of species, and it really opened my eyes to kind of the depth and breadth of nutrition work that, you know, is available. But it also really helped me understand the gaps and the questions that we still have. It was during that same time that I started working with the federal government. I've been a canine handler for the Federal Emergency Management Agency for more than 20 years now. And so that work as a handler, going through deployments, dealing with stress and, you know, the challenges associated with working dogs in the field, it really helped me develop kind of a passion for learning and for focusing on ways to help the performance and the management of these dogs that are so critical to humans in so many ways.
Can you tell us a little bit, a few examples of what is a handler actually, I know, entail? What do you have to do?
Yeah, so that's great question. Dogs are partners for humans in so many different ways. And you know, when you hear the phrase working dogs, a lot of people automatically think of military working dogs, law enforcement dogs. Maybe you think of the job that I do as a you know, search and rescue dog handler. And those are pretty obvious examples. But in the last decade or so, we've seen a huge increase in the partnerships that dogs have formed with humans. We've got dogs that detect cancer. We've got dogs that detect invasive species for conservation work. We've got dogs that are emotional support dogs, that are vision assistance dogs, that are diabetes alert dogs and seizure alert dogs. They are truly our partners in every sense of the word. And so when you think about a handler or an owner, really a better word is partner, because we are the other half for them. And so we're the ones that have to make sure they're healthy so they can do their job.
And again, all of those dogs, depending on what work they do, right, need really different kind of management and so on.
That's exactly right. And, you know, those are some really good examples to kind of think about. I suppose traditionally, when people consider the nutritional requirements of working dogs, most commonly you would think they need extra calories. They need, you know, maybe higher levels of protein because of the physical exertion associated with their roles. And that certainly may be true. But there are other considerations that we really need to keep in mind: the stress associated with the travel, the environmental exposure, whether it's high heat, whether it's, you know, severe cold. There's some real serious considerations that we need to give to keeping that gastrointestinal tract healthy and so that we can keep those dogs working.
Yeah, we're going to come back to a little bit later to all of those different kind of performance dogs. I just have a quick update about follow up on your CV. You also work close with the DoD, Military Working Canine Research Forum. Can you tell us a little bit about what does this entail?
Yeah, so part of my work as a canine handler involves deployments to disaster environments, disaster zones, and some of the deployments that we've been through, we've had dogs that have had pretty serious illness as a result. We've got incredible veterinarians that do an incredible job taking care of our dogs, but they have exposures to things in those environments, contaminants, you know, heat, cold. There's a lot of different things that are pretty nasty in those environments. And so a lot of the work that I've done with the DoD has been to provide expertise or to provide my insight with regard to how best to manage their skin health, how best to manage their dietary requirements when they are in those environments and they are exposed to those kinds of contaminants.
So, I mean, this is all fascinating, and I'm almost not sure where to start, right? Because I mean, I think it's really fascinating how many different areas you have. And I think maybe what fascinated me once, I think you told me once that when dogs are working, some of those military working dogs or the emergency working dogs, you know, their body temperature raises up to, you told me, how much is that?
Yeah, so one of the kind of biggest challenges, one of the most common causes of end of service life, and one of the most common causes for mortality and morbidity in working dogs, specifically military working dogs, is heat injury. It's generally highly preventable, but one of the problems is there's no really well-defined criterion. And so for, you know, one specific set of dogs, you know, a rectal temperature of 105 or 106 may be clinically emergent. And for other dogs, you know, they may be absolutely fine and be displaying no symptoms whatsoever. And so it's really difficult to be able to manage those dogs. And one of the reasons why that is important is because when those dogs are finished with their task, typically they get put up, they get put back in a crate, they get put back in a kennel, they may get put back in a vehicle, and we think we're letting them rest. But unfortunately, some of the research that I've done, we've actually learned that when they stop their task and you put them back in their kennel, their core body temperature continues to elevate for approximately 8 minutes after they've stopped working. And so, you know, taking them off that task and immediately putting them, you know, in that crate or in that vehicle, even if it's air conditioned, you still need to monitor them and you still need to, you know, be supervising their welfare, because if they were at a potentially, you know, clinically emergent threshold, they could increase even more so. And that's one of the, you know, kind of most important findings that's come out of our lab in the last few years.
So let me maybe get, I have a question though, you can tell us a little bit more. So how do those dogs actually get, you know, chosen, trained? So let's start from all the way from puppyhood, right? Is there like genetic predisposition? Maybe you can tell us a little bit. And then maybe let's focus on the two groups, the emergency working dogs, right? And a little bit the military working dogs. Or are they similar? I don't know, you can tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a great question. And so every dog has a job, right? Whether it's snuggling up with you on the couch, but dogs that do these specific jobs have a pretty specific set of behavioral characteristics. They're bold, they're fearless, they're independent, they're not bothered by noisy, you know, loud sounds, they're not bothered by strange new environments, they're not bothered by wobbly, you know, unstable footing, and they are absolutely insatiable when it comes to playing, you know, playing ball or playing tug. They love to play. And so these dogs have what we refer to as very high drive. And so the dog that your neighbor has that's just, you know, playing ball for hours and hours and hours on end, that a dog never wants to stop and it's driving your neighbor crazy, those dogs do, they do really well in our kind of programs because they love the game so much. And for dogs that are doing either military work or search and rescue work, the way that we train them is we turn it into a game. It's a game of hide and seek. And when they find either the item or the person, they get their reward. They get to play. And so using that very basic instinctive drive to hunt, which all dogs have to some degree, we can train them and utilize those, you know, those very instincts that make dogs so amazing. We can train them to save lives, to, you know, to find bombs, to find drugs. And that makes them, again, just incredible partners for us.
And so are there pretty much the same characteristic for both groups, search and rescue and military dogs? So you have a little bit of a divide in the characteristics.
So some of the base characteristics are pretty much the same. Again, you know, fearless, bold, courageous. Typically, we're looking for dogs in that working or herding breed kind of categories. We don't use a lot of small breed dogs for obvious purposes. There are specific disciplines that are looking for very individual characteristics. For example, dogs that are used for bomb detection purposes, we don't want dogs that have a natural tendency to dig for obvious reasons. For dogs that are utilized in the FEMA world, those dogs have to bark very naturally because they're traversing and searching very large areas. And so when they find that person that's buried, they have to bark to let their handler know where they are. And it may be pretty far away. So the dogs that don't have a natural inclination to bark, they're not very successful in our world. And dogs that tend to be natural diggers, they get washed out of the bomb program pretty quickly.
I couldn't imagine. So how does the training kind of, okay, so they're puppies, they're born, right? They're selected. Or how does it work from puppyhood all the way until they're properly trained and really ready for the being deployed?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different puppy screening tools, but you know, puppy genetics is something that we're still learning so much about. The team down at Auburn does just a phenomenal job studying puppy genetics and the impact of maternal rearing style, and whether or not you have bold or, you know, more independent puppies depends in large part on how mom takes care of them, which is absolutely fascinating. But for us, for the dogs in the FEMA world and dogs in the military world, what we're looking for are dogs that are medically sound, you know, no hip dysplasia. We've got to have, you know, clean hips and elbows, things like that. So we need dogs that are physically capable of performing very rigorous tasks. And so there is a lot of genetic screening that goes into that. And so we use dogs from a lot of different breeders, from a lot of different breeds, not just Labradors, not just German Shepherds. We use a lot of different breeds and a lot of different breeders to make sure that we have a lot of depth and breadth in our program.
Mm-hmm. And so I know that's from other work I was involved with, I mean, just to some periphery, but I think, so usually those puppies get screened and then they get to foster parents, is correct? Or how does it work? And there's a lot of, obviously with puppies, it's a a health challenge, stress, weaning, all of those periods. Can you tell us about more where the nutrition fits in afterwards?
Yeah, so working with puppies is a little bit of a crapshoot, right? Because they're still developing in so many ways. CCI does a phenomenal job developing puppies for their service dog program. The Seeing Eye does a phenomenal job developing puppies for their program, but not every discipline takes puppies, from basically weaning all the way up. Some disciplines actually prefer to start what we call young adults. So dogs that are 10 to 11 months old. So we've kind of got all the puppy wiggles out of the way because the work that they need to do is fairly physical, and you don't want to be doing those kinds of things with puppies. You want to let them be able to grow up and kind of just let a dog be a dog until they're able to really, kind of dive into those tasks. So depending upon the discipline and depending upon the path that dog is kind of pointed towards, they may or may not actually even be started as puppies.
Okay, that's very important. But maybe, I didn't know that, but nevertheless, let's go back a little to the puppy question, because I remember I had there's a lot of knowledge about this transition phase, right? From a puppy, when they leave the shelter, the organization, they go to foster, but it's a stressful period. Diarrhea is very common. And so the dietary changes. So can you tell us a little bit about this puppy development, the challenges, and how nutrition fits in, and how can we, prevent puppy diarrhea?
I think that's a great question. And I think that puppy diarrhea question actually has application probably throughout the dog's entire life. The stress and the transition that occurs during the weaning period is probably one of the most stressful events of the dog's life. And we know also during that same time frame that the dog's gastrointestinal microbiome is developing. And so we've got this, ecosystem that's trying to develop and kind of get started within the dog system. And that ecosystem controls immune function and mood and behavior and aggression and, socialization. And so all of those microbial links that we know are present at the adult phase of the dog's life, some of those questions just haven't been answered yet for puppies. And so there's a little bit of unknown factor to that. What we do know about puppy nutrition is that there's a huge amount of diarrhea that occurs in that time frame. Some of it, no doubt, is due to travel stress. We know that travel stress is very stressful on dogs of every age. We know that dietary fiber can help to prevent some of that. We know that we can actually do a better job of mitigating that risk of fecal inconsistency, but we don't have a really good method yet. We're working on it. We don't have a really good method yet for sort of preventive fiber therapy for dogs going through those stressful events. The GI development and the maturation of the GI system during those early young months of that puppy as it's developing up into a young adult, they're critical. They're, tissue accretion, we're building bones, we're building muscle, we're building cartilage, we're building a dog every day. They wake up with, millions more cells than they've than they had the day before, because their system is being built. And so managing nutrition, not just from a calories and, a protein standpoint, but managing it from the standpoint of really supporting the diversity of that microbiome, I think that that's one of the areas where right now we have a gap in our knowledge. But I definitely think that's something that in the next few years, we're gonna see a lot of questions answered in that space.
How about the adjustability? Because I think one of the major issues with puppies is that the GI function, right? Villas, they grow and everything, but not every puppy has the same trajectory, right? So I think absorbing the food, digesting the food is probably also a major cause of diarrhea. And then are there challenges or are there some needs for special puppy diets that we don't know yet?
I think there definitely are. I think we probably also at some point we need to go back and take a look at the way we measure digestibility. I think a lot of our digestibility models and knowledge are based off of, you know, Beagle trials and studies that were done that may not necessarily be reflective of the current technology that we have, you know, available to us now. And so, especially if we're talking about very high drive dogs or working dogs or dogs that have much higher levels of physical exertion, maybe that Beagle model isn't necessarily the best choice there. So I definitely think you're spot on in terms of the critical importance of digestibility. I think that's another gap in our understanding, and we definitely need to be able to answer some of those questions. Absolutely.
I mean, traditionally, a lot of also breeders and all puppies were thought of having infectious agents, right? So antibiotic use is still very common, unfortunately, which we know is a critical phase. I know from some breeders that almost 100% of their puppies are receiving antibiotics prophylactically before weaning. What is your current kind of understanding in the sports medicine or sports dogs? Is this still very common?
Yeah, I think unfortunately it is. I think the discussion surrounding a more judicious and a more targeted use of antibiotic therapy, that's a discussion that people are starting to have. But unfortunately, I think that is something that's going to take years to really make its way through the kind of the dogma within the industry. I think antibiotics are easy. And I think that's definitely a gap. But I think that's a gap in education. I think the use of, fecal transplant therapy, the use of prebiotics, the use of different, fiber therapies. There are definitely better ways that we can mitigate and treat that, as well as just being aware of the fact that some of that stool inconsistency is going to naturally resolve within a couple days if you do nothing. So I definitely think that those are conversations that need to occur more frequently. And that's one of the education gaps that I think breeders and veterinarians need to maybe have more conversation about, so that we can stop the use of antibiotics unless they are specifically warranted. And they certainly are in some cases, but just as a precaution or just as a, it's really unfortunate, because I think in some cases we're actually doing more harm than good.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
So let's move on again when they are like older now. So stress, you came up with stress a lot, right? So I'm sure that working dogs have stress. Is this a stress that is physiological? Is it pathological? Can you tell us a little bit?
So I think stress is a term that's used collectively, and sometimes it's anticipatory stress, right? So, when you pull up to your house and there's 20 cars outside and it's your birthday and all the lights are off, you probably get a little anticipatory stress because you think, your wife's probably got a surprise party going on in there for you. And working dogs, when they are in, the police car or the Suburban, or they roll up to that site and they know they're getting ready to go to work, they may start spinning in their kennel, they may start barking, they may start getting amped up. And that anticipatory stress is actually potentially beneficial. Now, conversely, most of the time when people use the term stress, they're talking about distress. And that's, more commonly associated with anxiety-like behaviors, dogs that are trembling, elevated cortisol, dogs that are displaying fearful or submissive body languages or body language type behaviors. So it's important to note that stress isn't always necessarily a bad thing. And so when you're talking about stress, in the context of nutrition, most commonly we're talking about exertional stress or heat stress or travel stress. Those are the three kind of big ones that we run into. Heat injury and heat stress almost always results in GI distress, you know, within 12 to 24 hours, sometimes bloody, hemorrhagic. And depending upon the extent and the degree of the heat injury, it can actually be life-threatening. Exertional stress, that tends to resolve pretty quickly. And so that fecal inconsistency, you may do a little bit of supplemental fiber, you may do nothing, and it may simply resolve on its own. Dogs that have kind of chronic or long-term exposure to stressors, dogs that are in shelters, dogs that have repeated exposure to travel, and they can really never normalize it. Those dogs may have more persistent and long-term GI, you know, related symptoms because their system simply, you know, from an endocrine standpoint, their system simply can't, you know, habituate to that level of environmental stimuli, and their body perceives it as stressful.
So what are the nutritional, say, challenges or solutions? Like, so stress can cause soft stools. A lot of people think the soft stool is infections, they give antibiotics. How can nutrition play in this role? You mentioned fiber. So are those dogs receiving fiber? Do they respond to fiber?
Yeah, that's a great question. My personal opinion is that structural carbohydrates and fiber are one of the very best tools that we have in our toolbox to be able to either mitigate or provide therapy for dogs that have these kinds of GI issues. Again, if we're talking about a medical condition, Giardia or, you know, parvo or something like that, that's completely different. If we're talking about travel stress, some kind of heat stress or exertional stress, supplemental therapy, prophylactic, you know, fiber, if you can get it on the front end, if you know that this is going to occur, some of the research that we've done in our lab has shown really remarkable results for dogs on very common fiber sources. We did a study just using green beans as a fiber source, and we did a very rapid untransitioned dietary switch from one diet to another, just to try to simulate a stressful environment for these dogs. And the dogs that got the green bean fiber on, you know, prophylactically as a preventative measure, they had half the rate of loose stools that the control dogs did. So we know that fiber given before a stressful event can actually prevent some of those loose stools. And so we feel like if we can stabilize that gut microbiome, if we can stabilize that microbial ecosystem, then we can basically stabilize not only the bacteria and protozoa and all of the different microorganisms living there, but we can stabilize the absorption. We can stabilize the rate of passage. We can stabilize the water resorption that's taking place. And all of those factors come into play when you're talking about working dogs that are traveling. I've had, you know, police officers contact me. They've had to pull their dog out of, you know, SWAT operations because the dog had such terrible diarrhea that they literally had to leave, you know, a mission in the field. And if we've got, you know, Secret Service dogs, or if we've got TSA dogs in an airport, I mean, we have dogs that are literally responsible for our national security and our national emergency response plan. And if those dogs are having some kind of, you know, acute GI distress, that's a big problem. And so if there's something that we can do on the front end before those dogs travel, before those dogs experience what we know is likely to be a stressor, then we're able to do a better job managing their GI health, which means we're doing a better job managing their performance.
Can you give us a little bit of a practical tip? So you said mentioned green beans, but when, how long, how about psyllium?
Yeah, anecdotally, I have tried psyllium. It's beautiful. It works very well. I've actually tried dried oatmeal, like the kind of, you know, Quaker Oats type of oatmeal. I've tried green beans. Many veterinarians for years have used canned pumpkin, not the pumpkin pie filling, but just plain canned pumpkin. And a lot of veterinarians have used those as kind of binders for years in dogs that already had loose stool or GI distress underway. And so if we take that same concept and we apply it on the front end, 12 to 24 hours before, you know, the event or the experience that's likely to be stressful, in my opinion, you are highly likely to reduce the incidence or the potential incidence of GI related symptoms. Yeah.
On the flip side, how about of fiber enriched diets that are long term? Would that be beneficial?
I absolutely think fiber-rich diets are beneficial. I don't think we're doing a good enough job in the industry of really expanding on the benefits of fiber, not only in terms of stabilizing that gastrointestinal system, but the potential benefits in terms of, metabolic byproducts and butyric acid and butyrate is the substrate that, colonocytes utilize to heal the gastrointestinal lining. So there are some specific fiber sources that provide very good fuel to help heal the gastrointestinal tract. So if we've got fiber-rich diets, especially for working dogs, especially for dogs that we know are likely to have these kinds of GI issues, then I think we are absolutely doing, we're positioning them to be able to either recover from or have therapy for those episodes if and when they do occur.
So that brings me to a question quickly. So are those current, there are official commercial diets specifically formulated for working dogs, correct?
Yes, there are. There are many diets out there that are formulated for working dogs. And most of them focus on higher calorie and higher protein content. Yes. And it's really unfortunate. And I think to some degree, we have to kind of own it in the industry ourselves and as consumers, we have to own that ourselves, because the pet food industry tends to be driven by consumer demand, and consumer demand tends to be driven by trends and maybe not so much facts. And so, the fiber component of pet food nutrition has gotten a bad rap because there was a lot of discussion and a lot of concern several years ago about grains and the term filler was thrown around, like somehow or another the grains aren't a viable nutrient source or a viable ingredient, and nothing could be farther from the truth. And you have to have balance, of course, but whole grains as a component of your dog's diet not only provide an excellent energy source, but they also provide some of that either soluble or insoluble fiber, depending upon, the ingredient type that you're talking about. And it's that really kind of broad, diverse array of ingredients that really helps to support the GI microbiome. And that diversity in ingredients leads to a more diverse microbial ecosystem. And we know that's how health is achieved overall, with a more robust and a broader, more diverse GI tract.
So in other words, it sounds like there's some clear work to be done, or some good, some good ideas how we optimize diets for working dogs. Because it also brings me to say fiber got to recognize the importance. Probiotics have been for the last 20 years, very popular, right? But actually fiber probably is more likely to achieve the benefits compared to probiotics. Is there any supplements for stress that you otherwise would know beyond that nutrition?
I think probiotics definitely have a place. And, when utilized under the care of, a supervising veterinarian for very specific purposes, I think they absolutely have a place. However, for managing general GI issues in a broad population of dogs, I think fiber therapy, preventive fiber therapy, long-term rotational types of fiber therapy is much more likely to have broader and more sustained benefits. Absolutely.
It's time for our famous three.
Tired of navigating the pet food industry alone? The Pet Food Inner Circle brings together the brightest minds in pet nutrition where seasoned professionals share real insights and tackle the challenges that matter most. When you need answers, industry leaders are just a conversation away. Ready to join the circle? Visit petfoodinnercircle.com and connect with your peers today.
So we're pretty much at the end of our episode. That was really fascinating. I mean, this is an area, obviously, from, you know, of high importance, but also like really also translational, right? So I'm always, let me ask you a few final questions. Those are a little bit off topic, right? But what are the best resources if anybody wants to go into the working dog or sports dog? You know, what kind of resources, books or kind of, you know, videos, where would they find some resources?
So the American Animal Hospital Association, Cindy Otto, Bess Pierce, Tracy Darling, there was a whole team of just incredibly brilliant minds, and they put together basically a toolkit for working dogs, and it included nutritional recommendations, it included exercise and fitness and conditioning recommendations. It included very specific descriptions of different types of working dogs and what they do, whether or not it's olfaction based or cognitive based. And I think it's a really good tool for people who want to learn more about the difference in working dogs, how their nutrition might impact their performance, because depending on whether or not they need to use their nose or they need to, you know, use their mouth or they need to use their brain to make decisions, you may feed them very differently.
Let me ask you a little bit more similar question, but a little bit more personal. Can you tell me your favorite book or resource outside your area, right? That really helped you thinking about, you know, your topic actually. So it's actually outside thinking of the box.
Outside. I really enjoy reading about science in other fields. When I used to work for Purina, and in full disclosure, I have worked with, collaborated with, and done research for a lot of different pet food companies. And I'm really proud to work in an industry that puts so much effort and resources and emphasis on getting it right for the dogs. And I think the investment that's been made in working dogs translates to companion dogs, because those, you know, the knowledge and the advancements that we've gained for working dogs allows us to utilize that same knowledge for companion dogs. But one of my favorite things when I worked for Purina, we used to sit around and just basically have ideation sessions about, this is what we learned, you know, in pigs, and this is what we learned in mice, and this is what we learned in fish. And all of these different fields would come together and talk about what they've learned. And then the rest of us would sit around and think about, how can I apply that to what, you know, I'm working on? And so one of the things that I really enjoy doing, I really enjoy looking at what human medicine and human nutrition is achieving, because obviously, you know, there's so many years ahead of us in terms of knowledge and the work that they've been able to do. And in some ways, I feel like it really gives us a roadmap. And so we can really look at that as a pathway for, you know, how to follow that roadmap, both good and bad, because, you know, some of the mistakes that they've made, obviously, we can be informed by that also. So I really enjoy looking at the science that's been executed in other fields and thinking about ways that could potentially impact our field.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much. So that concludes another episode of the Pet Food Science Podcast, brought to you by Wisenetics. Thank you so much, Erin. Thank you for joining us today. For our listeners, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated to future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. And until next time, this is Jan Sobiedowski signing off from the Pet Food Science Podcast. Bye-bye.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.